Tom.
Unto him.
Adarmi.
Adarmi.
In the matter of immorality.
Quitamatim.
The mind being so given.
Vilokya.
Seeing thus. Pitaram.
Unto the Father.
Sutaha.
Sons.
Marichi Mukhyaha. Headed by Marichi.
Munayaha.
Sages.
Vishrambhat.
With due respect.
Pratyabodayan.
Submitted as follows. Translation. Thus, finding their father so deluded in an act of immorality, the sages headed by Marichi, all sons of Brahma, spoke as follows with great respect. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The sages like Marichi were not in the wrong in submitting their protests against the acts of their great father. They knew very well that even though their father committed a mistake, there must have been some great purpose behind the show. Otherwise, such a great personality could not have committed such a mistake. It might be that Brahma wanted to warn his subordinates about human frailties in their dealings with women. This is always very dangerous for persons who are on the path of self-realization. Therefore, great personalities like Brahma, even when in the wrong, should not be neglected, nor could the great sages headed by Marichi show any disrespect because of his extraordinary behavior. Every living entity is subject to illusion. Every living entity is very small. His potency is very small. His knowledge is limited. His sensory perception is limited. And therefore his judgment can be wrong. Every living entity, he can make mistakes. Only God, who has perfect senses, perfect intelligence, unlimited information, he's never wrong. Anyway, by definition, whatever he does is right. But living entities, being subordinate, by definition, they can be wrong. They always can be wrong. Even the intimate associates, eternal associates of the Supreme Lord, who have his confidence and are always in his association, they can make sometimes mistakes. They will never fail to be devoted. They will never, their intention is always right, but they may do something wrong or even think something wrong. Of course, how in a spiritual body someone can make a mistake, that is hard to understand, but every living entity has a tendency to making mistakes. We may be living in the spiritual world, but we can fall down. And of course, that's a controversial statement, but it happens. That's how we got here. Prabhupada says it. We were with Krishna, and we fell down into the material world because of rebelling against Krishna. Otherwise, if we insist on the philosophical stand that nobody can fall down from Vaikuntha, then okay, that means we always were here. We were always in a material condition. And, our spiritual sarupa, our spiritual identity was dormant. It never was realized before. We're only going to realize it if we're lucky later on. Then whose fault is it we're an illusion? It's Krishna's fault then, if we take that stand. It's no fault of our own if we were created an illusion or created with no knowledge of who we really are. That is Krishna's fault. That makes it the essence of the philosophy totally different. What is our motivation to become Krishna conscious is the understanding that we are in an unfortunate deluded condition because of our own mistakes, because of our own misuse of our limited free will, our own wrong judgment, our deciding to rebel against Krishna. It is our fault that we're in this world. Therefore, we should feel sorry about it, and we should do something about it to rectify the situation. That's the basis of our whole philosophy and practice. Take that away, and what kind of Christian consciousness are you left with? You know, God put us here by his whim that we cannot judge, and God can take us out again by his whim. Nothing we do makes any difference. It's a totally different philosophy. Some Vaishnavas do consider that the reality. The followers of Madhvacharya basically think like that. And Christians, many of them, think like that. That it's just fate, that we're saved or we're damned. But no, we have a much more, a different viewpoint, that it's really our responsibility to do the right thing and to think the right thing. And that by at least making steps toward Krishna, we'll save ourselves. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu advises. He was preaching in India. He wasn't doing any preaching outside of India. So he limited his address to the Indians. But it's applicable to everybody. Bharata bhumite manusha janma hoilo jar. Janma sartha kukuri koro para upakar. Everybody who's been born in Bharat Desha, they should perfect their own life, make their own life successful, and then help others. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in that statement is emphasizing that we should take responsibility, initiative for our own spiritual life. Of course, we take shelter of spiritual masters and we follow their guidance. But that act of taking shelter is our own initiative. We don't just expect that the spiritual master is going to come and grab us, or the Krishna will grab us and give us a spiritual master. We have to want a spiritual master. We have to sometimes look for a spiritual master. Actually, in traditional culture, Vedic culture, spiritual masters didn't go canvassing for disciples. This is more the mood of Lord Nityananda, but it's not the normal way things are done. That Lord Nityananda would go door to door on the order of Lord Chaitanya. He and Haridas Thakur would go out on Sankirtan, bang on the doors of people's houses, and then when they opened the door, he would just jump in and roll on the ground, cry and beg them to take Krishna's name. The guru is canvassing for disciples. Of course, that's against ISKCON law. Yeah, but this is Lord Nityananda's pastimes, that he's begging them to become his disciples. That's his exceptional mercy. It's not the normal process. You can read in the Shatprashna Upanishad the more normal procedure. The six great sons of rishis wanted to get further enlightenment in spiritual life, so they went to Pulastya Rishi. I think it's Pulastya. And they each had a question to ask. They approached him. They were very qualified Brahmin boys. But he told them, you know, I don't know if I can answer these questions. You say you have some questions, I don't know if I can answer them. I suggest you go back home, practice austerities for 1 year, and then come back after that, and then you can ask your questions after you've done that. And if I'll see then if whether I can answer the questions. So the disciple has to go to the guru, find him. They went all the way up to the Himalayas or to his ashram to find him. And then he gave him a severe test. Sent him away. Come back after 1 year of performing austerities, and then you can ask your questions. And I don't know if I can answer them. So the guru is not going out of the way. The disciple has to go out of the way, prospective disciple, to find the guru and to beg him to give shelter. That's the traditional system. But because we're so fallen and so disinterested in spiritual life, Lord Nityananda is canvassing. He's begging us to take Krishna's name. So, okay, spiritual master is giving us guidance, but still it has to be our initiative. Even if the spiritual master is coming banging on our door, we have to take the initiative to open the door and invite him in, or to accept him. He's begging, he's offering, but still it's up to us to accept. The mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is coming on, is being offered to us, even though we don't deserve it. But still, we have to take the initiative to accept it. Brahma's sons are not pure devotees, except for Narada, but they're very cultured brahmanas. They're the experts in Varnashram Dharma, so they know how people should properly behave. Still, they're going to get cursed. Brahma has made a mistake, and really, they've made a mistake by criticizing. They're going to get. Actually, what happens? I don't think the curse is described here, is it? The actual cursing. That. Who cursed them?
Kumaras?
The Kumaras cursed Marichi?
No, I wasn't.
I don't know.
I think Brahma cursed.
He got angry and cursed them? I don't think he does here in the Bhagavatam. So I don't know. Hey, maybe Brahma got angry, but I don't think it's described here. We'll read in a few verses what he does do. Sorry, I'm not informed on that. But anyway, they're also not God, they're living entities. The venerable sons of Brahma, headed by Marichi, the Prajapatis, also could make a mistake. They're trying, to the best of their knowledge, to do the right thing. Still, it's a mistake. Arjuna, at the beginning of the Kurukshetra battle, decided he didn't want to fight, and he had so many good reasons from Shastra, especially from the Dharma Shastra and the Artha Shastra, why it would be wrong to try to kill his gurus. But that was wrong, and Krishna explained why it was wrong. Yudhishthira, at the end of the battle, didn't want to accept the throne. Arjuna had his crisis before the battle. Yudhishthira had a similar crisis after the battle. For months, he refused to sit on the throne and do his job as king, because he considered himself at fault for all these deaths and for the total disruption of society. Sridham yo madhata bandunam yodro ho ya upasthitaha karma bhiya grihamedi yair naham kolpo vipohitum. These women whose husbands it's my fault, have been killed, they all hate me. And the sinful reaction arising from that, I can't expect to expunge just by performing some Vedic rituals, these horse sacrifices and everything else that was suggested. You know, the sinful reaction that I've acquired by killing all these men and leaving their wives widows, there's no way I can ever become free from it. So he saw no solution. He was lamenting. He refused to just do his duty. This time Krishna could not convince him. You know, there's no Yudhishthira Gita, because Krishna tried to convince Yudhishthira, and even Krishna couldn't convince him to give up this dejection and just sit on the throne. Vyasadeva, other great sages tried. His brothers tried. Everyone else tried. Finally, it was only Bhishma who could, you know, change the mind of Yudhishthira, and Bhishma's instructions that Yudhishthira was able to listen to. And so his mistaken idea was finally corrected. So in the case of Arjuna and Yudhishthira, they didn't do anything wrong. They were just thinking about it. They were thinking the wrong thing. But that's also the mistaken propensity of the living entities to make mistakes. Yudhishthira, during the battle, Krishna asked him to tell a lie. Tell Drona that his son is dead. Then he's only living for his son. Then he'll give up fighting and you can kill him. Yudhishthira hesitated. I've never told a lie in my life. That's my principle, to always say and do the truth. So, Krishna, I can't do that. So Bhima, as usual, was impatient. He said, he went off with his club and killed an elephant called Ashwatthama. And said, okay, you can now say you killed, that Ashwatthama is dead.
But say Ashwatthama.
Gaja iti. Ashwatthama gaja iti yata.
He said Ashwatthama loud and then the elephant not right?
Yes. So, okay, he did what Krishna told him, but he hesitated to do it. Before that event, Yudhishthira's chariot wheels never touched the ground. They were flying in the sky, you know, levitating in the sky. Because he was perfectly truthful. After that one event, his chariot wheels began to touch the ground.
Why?
Well, this is the question. Some commentators, many people say, because he told a lie.
But he did not. He said, Ashwatthama, an elephant, not allowed.
But it was meant to deceive. You know, it was meant to get Dronacharya to think that his son was dead. And it worked. So it was, in effect, a lie. Although technically it wasn't.
And I think it was a lie, because he hesitated. He did not know it. Do what Krishna told.
Okay, so the mundaners think that Yudhishthira lost his charm, his chariot wheels touched the ground because he lied. But the pure Vaishnavacharyas say that no, because he hesitated to do immediately what Krishna advised. Therefore, because of that hesitancy, from then on, at least his chariot wheels touched the ground. Just a symbolic thing. He's still Yudhishthira. He's still a dear devotee of Krishna. But he also made that mistake of not simply immediately, with enthusiasm, doing what Krishna asked him to do. Even if that means breaking all your principles. The gopis didn't mind breaking all their principles when it was for Krishna's service. They were happy to be condemned and go to hell for Krishna's pleasure. But Yudhishthira had that hesitation. That's human. It's human to err. Even the spiritual master, we don't think that he's God. He's a human being. But he's kintu praborya priya evatasya. He has satisfied Krishna. He has the blessings of his spiritual master and of Krishna. Therefore, he's empowered, you know, to do that service of being spiritual master. But he's still a living being. We shouldn't expect that he can walk through walls and, you know, can never make any mistake. That's if we think like that, then we become fanatics. And if he ever makes a mistake, then our faith will just disintegrate. Faith should be based on intelligence, not on fanaticism. Okay, so I'll stop there. Any questions or comments? Yes, we have.
Delve into any controversial things, but I'm just wondering, like, you know, on the other side of the jiva issue, like, what, you know, they always quote Bhagavad Sandhava, that Jiva Goswami says something there.
What does he say?
I don't know.
I don't see anything that Jiva Goswami says in all the six Sandarbhas that backs their philosophy. They may take some things and misinterpret them. Which? The ones who say that we never fell down from Vaikuntha. Jiva Goswami, this is what the jiva is discussed as one of the energies of the Paramatma in the Paramatma Sandarbha, the third Sandarbha. This is where, if you're going to find that information, that's where you're going to find it. And he says practically everything you need to know about the jiva, including about his fallen condition and how he can be recovered. Although how the jiva can be recovered, how he can undo his fallen condition, that's more described in the beginning of the Bhakti Sandarbha. But as far as the jiva being fallen or becoming fallen, that's described in the Paramatma Sandarbha. But Jiva Goswami doesn't touch, actually, on the questions of from where was he and when did he fall down. He doesn't consider that a topic that can be discussed in human, you know, by human beings in human language. From our viewpoint, all we know is what can be described in human language, and the logic we can follow is the logic of material time and space. Our existence before our fall down was outside the scope of material time and space, wherever it was, in the causal ocean, or some limbo, or in Goloka, wherever. It was outside the material world. We're talking about where we were before we came into the material world. But it's something that we cannot understand in our language and logic. It's outside the scope of time and space that we know. Therefore, Jiva Goswami says nothing about it, actually. That's what I find, is that he doesn't touch on the issue of whether we fell from Vaikuntha, or where was it that we fell down from, and when was it that we fell down. Yes, he uses the term anadi. So does the Bhagavatam. But Prabhupada translates anadi as since time immemorial. He doesn't take it literally. No beginning. It means, immemorial means you can't remember. Memory, immemorial comes from the word memory. You cannot remember. It was so long ago, you can't remember when it was. That's all. Anyway, they can argue, but I don't see any evidence for their argument from the Sandarbhas. Jiva Goswami really doesn't get into that issue. He doesn't consider it an issue that we can settle, or that we can even understand. When we go back to the spiritual world and we have a different viewpoint, then we can understand.
Does it have any basis at all, the argument? Because it seems like it's like a kind of, in some ways, it's like an accepted argument.
It's accepted, that's the thing. It has its backing by many Vaishnavas, even many Gaudiya Vaishnavas in the Babaji line, in the Goswami line. It's practically only among the followers of Bhakti, Vinod Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta, and Prabhupada that we have this different idea that we were with Krishna and we fell down. But it seems to be Prabhupada's opinion. He established his magazine, Back to Godhead. How can you go back to some place where you weren't in the first place?
Yeah.
Simple. So it's our opinion, even if it isn't everybody else's opinion. So the only evidence, the only real backing for it is that it does have a lot of people who believe it. That we cannot fall from Vaikuntha, that we weren't in Vaikuntha. Anyway, so we're different than everybody else, but it's still our belief. Of course, there are devotees in the Gaudiya Mats who have been influenced by the Babaji opinions and therefore are not following the opinion of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati anymore on this. Or even of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, if you look carefully at what things he says. Bhaktivinoda Thakur does, in one or two places, talk about falling from Vaikuntha. Yeah, I don't have the exact page reference, but somewhere in Jivadharma he says it. Something about having fallen down from Vaikuntha.
I heard that a lot of times that they quote this part of Jivadharma, which says that some jivas come from Sankarshan and some from Sankarshan.
But that doesn't describe our original, our ultimate origin. It describes our entering into the material world.
Yeah.
Which is a periodic thing. It's that's not tracing it back to our origin.
Yeah.
Mahavishnu is a temporary phenomenon. We don't originate from Mahavishnu. We exist before we enter the body of Mahavishnu, and then from Mahavishnu we enter the material world. But that's just an intermediate stage. That's not our origin.
I guess they kind of take that part of it, which describes that this whole material world is like a lila place of the Lord where he can show his golden mercy element against the black background of the material world.
Yes. But that doesn't really, that even we accept that, but that doesn't contradict that we also have our autonomy. So Krishna's dealing with us as autonomous living beings, not just automatons, not just machines, robots. And that philosophy makes us into just robots, just pawns in the hands of a whimsical god. Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
Today's Shrine Ekadashi. Who is it exactly that's going to see performance?
Mahavishnu, no. Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. They're not, both of them. No? Of course, Mahavishnu doesn't do this every year, actually. We're sort of reflecting it on a year for Mahavishnu, or a day for Mahavishnu is, you know,
one
Nimesha is the duration of the whole universe. But we're just, you know, letting there's a replica of that time scale reflected in our own world, that every year the Supreme Lord lies down during the rainy season. It's description of the pastime of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu lying down in the Garbha ocean. Maybe more Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, the second Vishnu. Or both. Many of the descriptions of the pastimes of creation mix up, but sort of don't separate with a sharp line the appearance of, you know, the pastimes of those two lords. Both pastimes are described. Purusha Sukta, for example, you know, and places in the Bhagavatam where the same passage is describing both Mahavishnu and Garbhadakshaya Vishnu.
Right.
And then, you know, with your intelligence you can pick it apart, which, you know, but it's very often the pastimes of Mahavishnu are described in the same context as the pastimes of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. Because, you know, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu is just an expansion of Mahavishnu. Mm. Further expansion. Okay, Hare Krishna. Okay, so we'll stop here. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam.